You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there tends to be a big difference between the women depicted in media and advertising versus the general population. While those standards were unrealistic for most women before, a researcher tells us they may be getting worse. Right now, it's time for our Wisconsin News Roundup. We're checking in with a few different reporters from around the state about the stories they've been covering. First, a Schwabenon-based retailer Shopko announced last month that it's closing all of its department stores by this June. But Shopko's optical business is likely to stay in operation after it was purchased by a capital firm at auction last week. Jeff Bollier is a reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, we had this auction of the optical department at Shopko. What happened? What came out of that?
Well, so what we had over last weekend was Monarch Alternative Capital LP, an investment firm based out of New York City, bid $8.5 million in cash plus a few other considerations for the optical business, with an eye towards slowly transitioning it out of the Shopko big box stores and hometown stores and into their own standalone locations.
Is this a done deal? You wrote that still this has to be approved, right, by a judge overseeing the bankruptcy?
Yeah, so this is part of a bankruptcy case, so the judge has to approve all sales and transactions to try and generate money for the bankrupt company Shopko's Estates. So the judge has to sign off on it, and several landlords and other companies that Shopko owes money to, they kind of said, you know, we want to see final details and terms of this purchase before we decide whether we want to object to it. So there were some tentative concerns that they shared in a hearing on Thursday, but it does seem like most of the details have been ironed out at this point.
So for people who get their glasses and contacts at Shopko, and it sounds like there's a goodly number of those people, if
yes,
this
indeed
all works out as planned, what is this going to look like for them?
So Monarch's plan is to transition from Shopko stores, the optical business, out of those big box locations and into much smaller retail spaces. They hope to run about 84 standalone locations in 80 cities, and roughly about half of those will be in Wisconsin. So as Shopko, the store, kind of downsizes from its much larger, wider spread footprint, the optical business will be a little bit more regional, though it will spread across 10 to 12 states in the Midwest and West.
And this would save some, though obviously not all, of the jobs being lost at Shopko.
Yes, this would save about, they estimate about 700 jobs. It is hard to tell exactly how many, depending on if employees have found other places to work or other jobs at this point, but they estimate that this could save about 700 jobs out of the roughly 14,000 to 15,000 employees that Shopko had across its stores.
Jeff, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Jeff Bollier, reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. Now we move on to a story out of Port Washington. The city's Catholic parish, St. John the 23rd, recently fell victim to a financial scam that cost it $510,000. This comes as the parish is building an expansion onto one of its schools. Chris Halbig-Zeem is the Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now tell us how this Port Washington parish came to get scammed, basically, of so much money.
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Nobody seems to be quite sure how they were targeted, and I think that's part of what the police investigation is focusing on. But it's a very, very sad situation for the parish.
But it sounds like, and I guess this is something that any person or any business could be targeted by, somebody, what, pretended to be their construction contractor?
Correct. The parish received a letter purporting to be from the contractor saying, hey, we just changed banks. Here's our new payment information. This is where you should send it. Here's our account number, et cetera. And a few days later, someone called and said, hey, I'm from your construction company's accountant's office, and I just want to make sure you got our letter because I want to make sure, you know, all the numbers are straight. You know, they check the account numbers. And so when the parish made its next payment on its construction project, they thought everything was fine. And then they got a call from the bank, apparently, saying, hey, this might be fraud. You better check on it. And the whole thing unraveled.
And you talked to somebody, an investigator, I think it was, from the Better Business Bureau. I mean, $500,000 scam. This is not your garden variety scam. This is a big deal, even to somebody who watches this kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. When I told her the amount of money, I mean, her first reaction was just, oh, my God, I can't believe that. It's just, it's horrible. And especially to prey on a church where, you know, these are funds that were raised from parishioners to add on to their school. And, you know, it's just awful.
I was looking at the church's website, and obviously they're talking about this and worried about this. What kind of reactions are you hearing from the church itself and parishioners?
The church is just in shock. I mean, I think one of the parishioners I spoke to, one of the members of the school board, might have said it best. He just said this was a kick in the gut.
And finally, I mean, I guess there's no way to predict this for sure, but what is the timeline for an investigation like this to try to track down who's responsible for this huge act of fraud?
The police chief told me that these sorts of investigations are lengthy, and no one knows what the outcome will be. The Better Business Bureau investigator I spoke to said that, you know, often these are overseas scams. Often these things are, you know, they're just gone. The money's just gone. And the police chief said, you know, they're working with the FBI, they're working with the U.S. Attorney's Office, they've got search warrants out there, they've got subpoenas out there, but it's going to be timely. It's going to take time, and no one knows what the end result will be.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
That was Chris Helbig-Zeem, Port Washington reporter for the Ozaukee Press. And finally, Wisconsin's Conservation Congress recently released the collected results of its spring survey, with thousands of people weighing in on environmental and wildlife issues. One of the big issues in the survey was how to deal with chronic wasting disease in the state's deer population. Daniel Kading is a reporter for WPR News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Yay, thanks.
Well, several measures in this to combat CWD that got some support in this survey. What kind of ideas were on the table here?
Well, one of them was a pilot program called Payment for Positives, which would include offering incentives, a reward to kill deer infected with chronic wasting disease. So they supported that. The initial results came out as a majority in support of it, but they realized that there was an error in merging the online results with the spring hearing results. But people were still in favor of that idea of offering, in essence, a bounty to kill infected deer.
I understand the state had tried, Danny, a similar Payment for Positives program a little over a decade ago and abandoned that. Is there a thought that it would be different this time around?
Yeah, well, they're hoping that it might be different this time around because they'd be offering more money, for one. At least that's what the person who proposed this, Mike Foy, a retired DNR biologist, hopes. But also, an emeritus professor with UW-Madison says it could possibly work if you targeted the right deer, because essentially, how do you tell if a deer is sick or not? It doesn't show up right away. But he said adult bucks show the highest prevalence of the disease. And in some places, it's as high as 50%. So if you went after adult male deer, it could possibly work.
Now, the Congress making a vote like this doesn't put a thing into practice. How much weight does a survey like this of members have with the DNR or the state legislature?
Well, this is pretty unique. The DNR points out that, you know, other states don't have this kind of model where you're having a group of citizens provide direct input to the agency that creates rules to govern wildlife and fishing regulations. So this input will be taken into account as they develop those rules.
Now, we've got this, Danny, spread of chronic wasting disease has been going on for a couple decades now. What are we hearing lately from lawmakers and the governor about their plans to tackle this?
Well, there's been a lot of criticism of Governor Tony Evers lately because there was no funding included in his budget to tackle chronic wasting disease. He says they want to collect more information, more research before they develop a comprehensive strategy to address it. Republicans want to see something done. They don't feel, though, according to the Associated Press, Senator Tom Tiffany was interviewed, and he said he's not sure that a bounty program is the right way to go.
And in general, with the members of the Conservation Congress looking at the different items they voted on, there is definite interest in CWD, right? This is something they have on their minds.
Yeah, because another one of the proposals that was on there was a statewide baiting and feeding ban, which is something that DNR Secretary Preston Cole has questioned recently, that why would we do this? Because when you have crowding of deer, there's a more likely possibility that you could transmit the disease. So they want to see that done away with.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about results from the latest survey by the Wisconsin Conservation Congress and to wrap up our weekly review of news from around the state. Our culture has long suggested what the ideal female body might look like, based on things like who's modeling the clothes we see when shopping online or what we see in ads or TV or beauty pageants. For a while, that look has been thin, skinny. But now new research has shown that the so-called ideal female figure is now not only thin, but also fit and muscular. And that combo is likely to be even harder to live up to. Frances Bozick is a clinical psychology doctoral candidate at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She co-authored the piece, The Ideal Female Body Type is Getting Even Harder to Attain. You can read that at The Conversation. Frances, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the particulars of how you research this, what is the overall trend you're seeing in what our society sees as the ideal female body type?
So I think the main thing that we were highlighting in this article is that historically, like you said, there has obviously been a drive for women to be exceedingly thin over time. And one of the things that seems to be happening more recently is that there's also this push to have the appearance of muscularity. And that, coupled with the extreme thinness, is basically the reason why we're saying it's even more difficult to kind of have this figure.
Let's talk about what's at stake there. If there is this ideal a female body type out there that is not realistic for most women, what kind of damage does that do?
So I think one of the things that makes this particularly damaging is that in the past, I think there was kind of an understanding that the thin ideal was very difficult to attain. It took a lot of dieting, but I think the incorporation of the muscularity piece has kind of begun to conflate this with health. And I think that psychologically, especially, it can have an impact on women that is negative, even though it's kind of masquerading as a health push. Because, you know, when women are subjected to images of these ideal figures, that we see the same sorts of negative impacts that we would have seen with the previous media, but now there's kind of this idea that this is actually related to health and therefore something that is even more, that's more reasonable or, I guess, healthier for women to strive for.
Now, can you talk about some of the research you've done to track this this change and how it's happened?
Yeah, so one of the things that we did was over time, there has been a lot of research that has looked at figures in the media that are being presented to women to kind of understand what are women being pressured to look like. So we wanted to kind of continue that trend. And so what we decided to do was to look at Miss USA winners over the course of about 15 years. And we had students rate these women on thinness, muscularity, and attractiveness. So it was pretty straightforward. But we standardized the images of these women and then had undergraduates rate them. And what we found was that women reported that they were seeing these winners become thinner and more muscular over time. And I think this was a particularly unique population, and that other studies have looked at contestants in general. And so we were basically, this study suggested that having that extreme level of thinness has not gone away and is still something that is highly sought after, but also now there's this extra piece of having the appearance of muscularity as well. And so the other thing that we wanted to really look at was whether or not women have started to internalize this ideal. So is this something that they actually want for themselves? So we know they're being presented with it, but do they care? And so the other thing we did was we presented women with images that were completely identical except for the level of muscularity. So in one version, muscularity had been edited out, so people were seeing either a muscular and thin or a thin-only version of the same woman. And what we found when we asked women about their preferences between those was that women preferred a female figure who was extremely thin but also had that muscularity component, which suggested that this is something that women have begun to regard as something that they should strive for and work to achieve.
Talking to Frances Bosick with the University of Missouri, Kansas City, talking about her piece she co-authored, The Ideal Female Body Type is Getting Even Harder to Attain. And Frances, we're getting messages like this from a new angle. Now, if you see something in an ad, you know, somebody's selling you something, maybe you can ignore that. A beauty pageant, okay, that's a thing. A Hollywood actress, sure, they're training all day. But now we've got social media and a lot of people who look like maybe normal people trying to spread these images as well. What kind of things are you seeing on places like Instagram and elsewhere?
So Instagram and social media actually was one of the first places where we started to see this trend. And so I think that is where some of this research started coming from, and it kind of led us to look into what is the impact of this media. And I think one of the things is that idea of it being like a normal everyday person, again, takes away from your propensity to critically evaluate what you're being presented with. So I think that can be kind of a detrimental piece. But I also think that with time, even in the last 10 years, what we are presented on social media is typically a reflection of what we're looking for. And so I think that also makes this even more complicated and a little worse for women, in that women who are more likely to have body dissatisfaction and be seeking out these messages potentially anyway are going to be more negatively impacted when they view them. So I think that's something to be aware of and just as you consume some of this media.
I could see somebody seeing maybe a positive here, like, hey, we're finding a strength in women to be an attractive trait where maybe in the past we didn't. Do you see that or no?
So I think that is one of the things that people have tried to tease apart. So one of the problems with the way that the messages have been presented is that typically, one, they kind of portray women in what we would consider to be an objectifying manner. And so what we say when we say that is really focusing on areas of muscularity that would be important for appearance. So like looking at someone's abdomen and really kind of fragmenting the woman so that she's not considered to be like a whole strong, powerful person, but more focusing on what is the appearance piece that she's achieving here. So there's that piece that I think it's important to be aware of. And then the other piece is that we have found that a lot of the messages that tend to accompany this media focus on really appearance rather than health messaging. So, and it can be very guilt laden and things that, again, when we see these with, you know, images of models and strictly thin women, you might be more likely to expect this and might be less impacted by it. But I think there is more ambiguity in terms of like whether or not this is completely healthy for women. I think it does inspire women to want to have a more fit body, which obviously any engagement in exercise and physical activity for cardiovascular health is a great thing. But I also think that you just have to critically look at how the message is being presented and what it's saying. So,
and I understand you're hoping to extend this research now, looking at women over the age of 35. What are you going to be looking for?
So I would like to see if some of these messages operate the same way. So historically, we have done a lot of this research with women who are in an undergraduate sample because we had a belief that body dissatisfaction kind of was the most prevalent there and kind of stopped afterwards. And so I'm really interested in finding out whether or not these kind of relationships also exist for middle-aged women going up to even the age of 60, because we know that body dissatisfaction continues on, but the messaging and the forums in which women gain information about the appearance standards that they're supposed to achieve might be different. So,
and briefly, Frances, as we wrap up, are you hoping that just having this information out there will maybe send a message to women to think carefully about the images they're seeing?
Yes, I think that was the goal of what we've been doing so far, is just to kind of help women empower themselves by being kind of critical consumers of the things that they're being shown. And again, having that idea that obviously fitness and health in and of themselves are very worthwhile goals and definitely worth pursuing, but also just keeping an awareness about what is being shown to you and the impact that it's having on mood and self-esteem and things like that, particularly if you're susceptible to body dissatisfaction and things like that in the first place.
Frances, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Frances Bozick, a clinical psychology doctoral candidate at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. She co-authored the piece, "The Ideal Female Body Type is Getting Even Harder to Attain," for The Conversation. In Wisconsin, 89% of the state lives in a county that's losing what's called prime working age people. That's people between the ages of 25 and 54. That's according to an analysis from Moody's Analytics and the Economic Innovation Group, a bipartisan policy research firm. The group's teamed up on a new report looking at how that decline in growth is impacting places like the Midwest. And the authors have a potential solution, a Heartland Visa that would bring skilled immigrants into selected communities. John Lettieri is the president and CEO of the Economic Innovation Group. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, paint a picture for us of these communities seeing this loss of population, the loss of this prime working age population.
Sure. Well, what we lay out in the report is a three-pronged demographic challenge that our country is facing that's being felt especially acutely in certain regions of the country. And the first is the rapid aging of the country's population. The second is that a great swath of the country is losing population over the last decade, and an even larger swath is losing prime age population, so about 80% of the country's counties. And those three demographic challenges are hitting certain regions especially hard. So you have a national issue of slow population growth and an aging population, but the effects of this are really concentrated in particular areas. And so what we're laying out in the report is that population loss is not just a consequence of economic decline in many areas. It's also a cause of economic decline. We look at the housing markets of these communities. We look at the fiscal health of the communities. And we look at the startup rates, the new business formation. And we show how population loss has a causal effect on all of the kind of negative outcomes that we're concerned about. And as you noted, we look at what are the potential policy solutions that can help certain communities adjust to these demographic challenges.
I want to bring this here to Wisconsin now. Looking at your map, and you show the counties that are gaining working age population and the counties that are losing this working age population, where it's going down. If I'm reading your map right, there's exactly one county in Wisconsin that's gone up and all the rest have gone down. That's Dane County that's gone up. Am I reading that right?
There's two, actually.
Oh, I missed one.
You're right. 97% of Wisconsin counties are seeing a shrinking of the prime age population, and fully half are seeing an overall shrinking of the population over the last decade. So this is a state that is feeling the larger effects of U.S. demographic decline, particularly acutely.
Now, bring us into a community that might be experiencing this. What is happening to the economy when they have that net loss of working age people?
Sure. Well, especially in an already tight labor market, you've got less availability of workers, and especially skilled workers, you what happens is the tax base erodes. You've got less fiscal strength in the community to pay for city services, to pay for schools, to pay for local infrastructure. You've got housing vacancy that starts to spread, and we know that housing vacancy can often lead to blight. Blight leads to crime. And so these challenges become more expensive. What also we're finding in the report is that migration out of these communities has become skill biased. And so there's a big gap between the education attainment of those who leave a population losing community and those who remain behind. And it, as you might guess, it tends to be the higher skilled, more educated folks that who have options in other labor markets who tend to be the ones who leave. But the big takeaway here is that most people stay. And so the idea that we can just allow large swaths of the country to slowly decline or just encourage everybody to move all of a sudden to San Francisco or New York, we think is one that's not practical and doesn't fit with the reality of what we're seeing across the country. So that's why we need to do better at bringing opportunity and giving new tools and resources to communities that allow them to adjust and reinvent and to thrive even as the economy changes.
Talking to John Lettieri from the Economic Innovation Group. And John, let's get into one of those tools you lay out in this report, the Heartland Visa. What is the idea you're throwing out here?
Yeah, so the broad structure of this idea is that we have this tremendous national advantage, which is that skilled and entrepreneurial people from around the world very much want to be here. And at the same time, as we've just talked about, we have some significant national challenges, particularly related to demographics and the need for more skilled workers in more pockets of the country. And so the basic premise of our suggestion here is that we should connect those dots, that we should do a better job connecting welcoming communities who have a clear need, which again represents quite a bit of the country, and skilled immigrants who want to be here and would gladly choose to go to many of these communities, and to give them the choice to opt into each other. So communities opt in to being eligible to host these skilled visa holders, and the immigrants opt in to choosing a welcoming community. And so you're getting a match from both sides, and a match that increases the odds of success for both the community and the immigrant. And the idea would be that rather than tying, as we currently do, exclusively skilled visas to a single employer, which, by the way, is also a way of tying them to a single place in the market, it's that we would tie them to a place and give them the chance of choosing, in our suggestion, either a county or a collection of counties that would be eligible under the criteria that we've laid out, and letting them work anywhere within those local labor markets, which gives it's beneficial for the immigrant, but it's especially good for the community and the local businesses because they have access then to this infusion of skilled talent that we know is an essential ingredient. And every community that's doing well around this country, it relates back to the clustering of skilled and educated workers. So there's not a mystery. Whenever you see a place that's really thriving, it's because, and this is increasingly true in the last decade or so, it's because these are places that skilled and educated workers are congregating. So we need to give communities more tools to connect with that type of human capital. And right now, our federal immigration policy is overwhelmingly biased towards superstar coastal metro areas. And we think that because of the benefits of skilled immigration are so strong, we need to give more communities an opportunity to benefit and more immigrants an opportunity to connect with such communities.
So define skilled for the purpose of this Heartland Visa. What kind of skills are we talking about?
Sure. Well, it can be a wide range. And I'll say at the outset, what we do in this report is really just lay out a potential framework. This is not a specific legislative proposal. This is not a bill that could be introduced tomorrow. It's a set of principles, how to think about both addressing the challenge and what the features of the solution would look like. So I just laid out one of them, which is the dual opt-in nature. The skilled nature of this could simply be you have a college education, and it could be a worker that covers everything from healthcare to engineering to software, architecture. You know, the needs are broad and the skills are broad. And so we should think about where we want to set that dial. But the key there would be sub-level of education attainment and skills acquisition that puts them in an upper tier.
And for hypothetically that recipient of this place-based skill visa, what happens to make sure that they stay in the place?
Right. So what we talk about in the report is that there's a huge demand for skilled workers in the economy, and that it's very easy. If you have a college degree or more in this economy, your unemployment rate is negligible. It's extraordinarily likely that you will find work. And when the on-ramp here is if you remain compliant, you get the chance to extend your visa, and then if you remain compliant beyond that, you get the chance to get a green card. That's a very strong incentive for a skilled worker who can almost certainly find productive work in almost any labor market around the country. It's a very strong rationale for compliance, because if they comply, it's an on-ramp to permanent status in the country via a green card. So that's the basic rationale. Of course, in a fully fleshed out legislative proposal, you'd be thinking about other specific enforcement mechanisms, but it's more carrots and incentives than it is anything else, because the incentive to be in this country and to have, as a skilled worker in particular, to have the chance to find productive work and economic opportunity is so strong that the carrot of permanent residency and a green card is a very it's a very powerful one in terms of compliance.
Talking to John Letieri with the Economic Innovation Group, co-author of a report on the declining working age population in many communities around the country, here in Wisconsin and the wider Midwest, and a possible solution, a Heartland Visa, trying to bring skilled immigrants into these communities to bring skilled workers there. Call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea for visas for skilled people maybe in your part of the state? And are you seeing this kind of population change where you live? Aging population, not as many working age people there, and not as many skilled people. Are you having trouble finding doctors, lawyers, other professionals in your neck of the woods? How's that affecting your economy, your local government and school funding? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the effects of population loss in communities around the Midwest, especially prime working age and especially skilled working age people. Our guest says one possible solution is what they're calling a special visa program, the Heartland Visa. John Letieri is with us from the Economic Innovation Group. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Are you in a community where you think, hey, this could help bring in skilled immigrants with this special visa who would have to stay and work and do their job in your town, in your county? Are you seeing these population changes where you live? Are you seeing a decline in the number of people? And how's that affecting your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. John, before we go to our callers, you lay out some of the hopes for this Heartland Visa in terms of how it might help with entrepreneurship and job creation in these communities we're talking about. What would you be hoping for?
Sure. Well, what you'd hope for is a stronger connection between communities facing some of these demographic challenges. But in many cases, there's still wonderful places to work and live and still have a lot of economic opportunity. They're just facing the brunt force of some of those larger demographic shifts that we're talking about, with human capital that, again, brings a variety of specializations to a local economy. Put it to you this way, no community wants just one doctor. You want multiple doctors who could specialize in multiple different fields, for example. And that's the effect of skilled people coming into a workforce, is it allows for more specialization, more expertise, and that has an uplifting effect on everybody. It's good for everybody because new migrants into a community from wherever they come from bring not just a supply of skilled work, they also bring demand. They have demand for local services, for local businesses. They become consumers in the local economy, which helps with the virtuous cycle that every community needs to continue moving forward. And as we touched on earlier, it's really about putting a lot of the extra capacity of these communities back to productive use. When you see population loss set into an area, what you start to see are, again, vacant seats in schools, less of a healthy tax base, to pay for city services. You see vacant housing. And so the effect of bringing new people in and opening those channels, again, from wherever they originate, it's to fill that excess capacity, put it back on the tax roll, put it back to productive use, which has an uplifting effect on everybody. And so those are the types of effects you're going for here. And again, we know it works. We've seen in communities around the country where opening their doors to immigrants has had a tremendous effect at reversing the local momentum and getting that positive growth back. So I want to emphasize, this is not really a hypothetical. It's just that a lot of communities are doing this absent any policy support from Washington. They don't have the kind of programmatic, specific, intentional support from Washington that they need, but they're doing it as best they can. They're building an economic development strategy that incorporates being welcoming to immigrants, and it's having an effect. So that's what gives us the sense that maybe not every community opts in, but the ones that want to, there's a really strong rationale and there's a really strong track record of this working in communities around the country. So we're very optimistic that the uplifting effect would be clear and immediate, and that this is the kind of thing that can help demonstrate, again, why we shouldn't just have policies that support clusters of high-skilled people in large coastal metros, but it should be really something that every community has a chance to enjoy.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. What I see here is for the people that have been left behind, ages 20 through 60, they're educated. We speak English. We have first, second, and third shift, but the Midwest has a transportation problem. I don't think you're too old to work when you're the ages of 20 to 60-something. So we're not all aging, but we do have a transportation problem to work.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. So is there a case to be made, maybe instead of looking for immigrants, maybe we find places where there are people and not a lot of employment and try to do similar things like, to provide education to people in cities, but on the condition that they work in these other communities for a while?
Well, I think providing incentives is a great idea. You have some states experimenting with this now where you have for teleworkers, for example, who can live and work anywhere, you give them an incentive to come settle in a specific city, and that could be a reason to take advantage of certain types of clusters of workers that have a lot of mobility. But there's a fundamental, when you look at the regional level and the national level, it's not just an issue of upskilling the current workforce or making tweaks on the margins. We have a supply problem in this country, a supply of human capital that is kind of inescapable when you look at the data. And so we have to do something on both ends. We have to create the right kind of incentives for and the right kind of tools for workers who are already here. But we also have to find ways to connect with more. And again, this is not hypothetical. We already do this. We have done this historically as a country quite successfully, but we don't have as intentional a policy about how to ensure that more places benefit from it as we should. And we certainly are not taking full advantage of the fact that, again, the U.S. remains, at least for now, a place where skilled and entrepreneurial people the world over really want to come. And that entrepreneurial piece is important. The country is also suffering from a decline in startup rates. So entrepreneurship and business formation are actually quite near their historic lows, not their historic highs. And one antidote to that is that immigrants tend to be overwhelmingly entrepreneurial. A great share of overall entrepreneurship, overall business formation in our country is generated by immigrants, and especially the children of immigrants. So you get at both the demographic and the entrepreneurial challenges at once by taking advantage of something that we've long taken advantage of as a country, which is welcoming people from around the world who can add something to our communities and add something to our country.
Thanks for the call. I'm going to go now to John in Sherwood. John, hi. Joe in Sherwood. Hi.
Oh, I'm concerned about the aging population that's being pushed out of the workforce because of automation. And if these companies could retrain the aging population to stay in the workforce as long as they can.
Joe, thanks for the call. And John, is there a potential supply there? Aging workers being retrained for some of these kind of skilled jobs, or maybe partial retirement from those bigger cities to communities that need skills of, say, the retired doctor or what have you?
Sure. Well, look, the challenge of ensuring that people can remain attached to the workforce for as long as they want to is one that's always been present in our economy and something we should be mindful of. The employment rates for older workers are actually pretty strong. And so you don't see some kind of mass displacement happening, certainly not because of technology in our economy. And I think this is one of those areas where it's certainly true in certain communities and it's true in certain industries. But as a whole, that's not a challenge we're actually facing right now as a country today. It's possible that it could happen down the road. But the employment rates for older workers is pretty strong, and the technology-based displacement that we see in the economy is not particularly high, especially against historic shifts that we've seen in the last 100 years. So I think, again, the problem that we should be worried about is in many ways fundamentally a supply problem. It's one of the kind of workers and the kind of entrepreneurs that can really create more opportunity and stronger attachment for more people in the workforce. And again, that's really key. With supply comes demand. If you have new workers, skilled workers, and entrepreneurs populating a local economy, what that does is create a stronger demand that pulls everybody else into the local labor force even more strongly. And when that churn slows down, it's the marginally attached workers, ones with less skills, ones with less of a track record in the economy, they're the ones that are first out. And so you want that healthy churn, and it starts with an influx, a renewing influx of workers and entrepreneurs that bring skills and dynamism to a local labor market.
John, in just our last minute, immigration, of course, is a hot-button issue. Do you think this is something that Republicans and Democrats in Congress could get behind and pass a law to make this a reality?
I absolutely do, but it's not going to happen without a breakthrough on the broader set of immigration policies. Everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike, agree that our current immigration policy is broken. And one of the most unfortunate things about that is that we are taking for granted that the advantages we enjoy today will always be there for us. And that's just not the case. No country has ever been able to sit on their advantages and maintain them forever. We have to work at it. And this is one area where again, everybody agrees we're broken. Everybody agrees we need a way to fix this. And we think when the time comes to fix it, when there is a breakthrough, ideas like this are going to be on the table because they bring such obvious benefits, especially to places that are at risk of being left behind in our economy. And so we know that there's bipartisan interest in that issue. How do we lift up and bring along places that have seen fewer benefits in the economy in recent years? And this issue sits at the intersection of the need to reform our immigration system and the need to ensure that we're not leaving communities behind.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
That was John Lettieri of the Economic Innovation Group, a bipartisan public policy research organization. He was with us today to talk about a report they produced with Moody's looking at an idea called the Heartland Visa, a policy that would let skilled workers immigrate to places dealing with a loss in working age population. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a national report says Wisconsin has seen the fourth biggest decline among states in funding for higher education. An education expert joins the show, and you can share your thoughts. Spending a year in orbit can really change a person. We'll take a look at NASA's findings about the biological impact of life in space. And keep your eyes on the sparrow. We'll get an up-close look at the unsung heroes of the songbird family. That and more, it's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.